With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Curzon Film Podcast. I am Irena Muzumeci.
And I am Jake Cunningham.
And it's time to call me by your name.
Ha ha ha.
So thank you so much for joining us. It's lovely to have you here. We are going to be talking about one of the most well-reviewed films of the year, as well as talking to its director, who I spoke to, and I still can't pronounce his name, even after he's corrected me. So Irena, if you would.
It's Luca Guadagnino.
Luca Guadagnino.
Excellent.
Got it? Brilliant. All right. So you've been away for a bit, actually.
I have. I was in Berlin, not for a long time, just a kind of few days. I went to take a look at our colleagues at York Cinema's brand new cinema, which is near Zoo Station in Berlin. Kind of quite a sort of seedy area, but up and coming and really changing. And they've built this brilliant 7-screen new cinema where I got to see Blade Runner 2049. And it was terrific. I had a really good time. And hopefully we managed to bring these guys on at some point and chat to them.
Yeah, yeah. When you said you're in Berlin, I thought, oh, I'll bring that up on the podcast. That'd be nice. It's like, what specifically shall I talk about? And it shows that we're very much in sync in that my note was, oh, they've just got a new cinema, haven't they?
Yes.
There's something to talk about.
Plus, the European Film Awards will be in Berlin this year, I think. And I remember you guys went to cover
last year. Went to Poland last year for that. And we're hopefully going back to Berlin for more coverage this year, which is better than, hopefully be better than the last time I was in Berlin for the 2016 festival. And got food poisoning on the plane over.
Oh, exciting.
Yeah, and spent 4 days in bed and then left without seeing a film. Oh, it's a great festival.
Brilliant festival experience.
Yeah, really, really good. Loved it. And actually, you did an Instagram whilst you were there featuring your husband, explaining why your love life has been dictated by Indiana Jones, which is something I can definitely relate to.
Yes. We went to this archaeology museum and I married a historian. I think... Yes, I would attribute every single crush of my life to Indiana Jones.
Yeah, I think I'd do the same. All right, so let's get on to the film, which has been breathing new life into the peach emoji. It is Call Me By Your Name. And Irena, you did the research beforehand. I lazily have not read the book, but you can tell us about it.
I have read the book, and I didn't love this book. Weirdly, I think it's one of those examples of a film that's much better than the novel. I know the novel has this kind of cult status, really, for a certain generation, particularly of gay men, I think. It didn't quite... the novel is all told from a very kind of internal perspective, from the point of view of this 16, 17-year-old. And there's a lot of teenage brooding in it and kind of extreme emotions. And it sort of works. It's sort of, you know, what you see on screen is very faithful to the novel, but somehow removing that voice and actually observing this character go through the emotions, particularly as he's very well performed by Timothy Chalamet, really made a massive difference to me. There's also like a couple of scene changes. The director and screenwriter, James Ivory here, have decided to relocate some of the action. So it moves from a relatively nondescript, actually quite deliberately non-identifiable location, which you are meant to understand is somewhere between Liguria, so the Cinque Terre, and Tuscany, because of a reference to the place where Percy Shelley drowned. And they relocate the bulk of the action from this place to Crema, which is where Luca Guadagnino was raised, although not born. Then at the end of the film, the characters take a trip, and in the book, they go to Rome, whereas here they go to Bergamo, which is quite a small town in the north of Italy. And it's quite an interesting scene change. I think it does things to the kind of representation of Italy, which we can absolutely talk about. And it's very effective. I found it really quite a smart way of adapting the novel.
Because I do, in the interview, which we'll play in a bit after we've discussed the film, I do kind of ask about this eye on Italy, which I think you'll be able to input on, in that maybe the book takes more of a tourist gaze about it.
Not necessarily, but you certainly don't get as much of a sense of place, I don't think. There's quite a lot of references to certain big famous people who've been in certain places. And here, just out of purely placing the camera elsewhere and locating it in a different place that has not been as represented in cinema as perhaps the Tuscany that we see in quite a lot of particularly American and British films, it's got a sense of authenticity about it and much more of an organic relationship, I feel, like between the characters and this place that they go on holiday to every year and the kind of connections that they make with the place. So I found this really quite brilliant, actually, and the representation of Italy far away from these tourist locations was really fresh to me.
Yeah, I mean, this film will actually, by giving you not the representation of Italy you're used to seeing on screen, will actually make you want to go to Italy more than any, I don't know, Palo Sorrentino or something.
Yes, definitely. There's also something to be said about this collaboration between James Ivory as screenwriter and Luca Guadagnino as filmmaker, which I think is extremely productive. James Ivory has written and directed a number of films set in Italy, which kind of take this gaze that probably comes from the source novel. So I'm thinking here of his Room with a View and Morris, even to a certain extent. But in the E.M. Forster novels, there is always a sense of Italy as this incredibly liberated place where people can live their desires and sexuality and be exposed to just a way of living emotions and feelings in a completely different way. This would be quite remote from the experience of Italy that most of us Italians have growing up in a place that actually Guadagnino does attempts to show as quite restrictive and quite tied to a particular kind of history. He does this in very subtle ways that are not always entirely successful, but at the same time, there's something in the collaboration between a screenwriter who is clearly placing an eye on Italy as this place of extreme emotion and the filmmaker who absolutely sees the attraction of nature, weather, location, and these places where history is really inbuilt into the stones.
There's an interesting development since the book was written, that how the story was going to be told and who was going to be telling it has really had a bit of a journey. And we haven't actually really talked about what the story is.
No, we haven't.
So we do have a young chap, Elio, who goes to, well, in the film it's Crema, with his mum and his dad to this lovely old house, and his dad studies there. I think it's every summer and every Christmas they go there.
Yeah.
He is an archaeologist, and they do digs and dives around the area, and there have been a number of PhD students that have come over each time to work with his father. And in the summer that we meet the film, we have Oliver, played by Armie Hammer, who is the PhD student who's studying with his father. And they develop a relationship, Elio and Oliver. And this started out as a book written by Andre Assaman, and then it was bought up by James Ivory, and James Ivory wrote the screenplay. And James Ivory was approached to co-direct this, or direct it, and then it was taken to Luca Guadagnino.
Guadagnino.
And then they said, okay, why didn't you, you could co-direct it, and then it's 10 years later, and Ivory, I think, has just kind of reached a point and just sold his script. Yeah. And so that's why on the screenplay we now see James Ivory and Guadagnino and Walter Fasano as well, because this is no longer completely Ivory's script.
Mm. Like I said, I think this cooperation really benefits everybody. It kind of gives James Ivory a much more realistic and fresh eye onto Italy. It gives Guadagnino something that I have never seen him do, which is to allow the camera to move freely. It feels like an incredibly free flowing movie, very much removed from the kind of visual stylistical,
like I Am Love or A Bigger Splash, they're so ornate you feel like you don't even want to touch them. They're like you feel like there's a velvet rope around them, and this, we can actually walk in and we can actually interact with people. We're actually given an invitation into the film.
Absolutely. And it, just the sensual nature of this feels so far away from even the kind of exoticism of Italy that you see in A Bigger Splash, where there's still this element of kind of everyone is dislocated in this place and therefore they experience things that are completely out of the ordinary. Whereas here, these characters feel totally like they belong to the place. Elio in particular, I found that there's this really lovely sense in which the film moves with him. You know, everywhere he is, he kind of affects the way the frame moves around him. He moves the music of the film with him. Every time he kind of walks in, there's almost like a theme tune that's playing in his head, and you can share it with him, and you hear him, and you watch him move, and you see his body kind of in this place, and how much he belongs there, and how much it belongs to him. So the introduction of Oliver is extraordinary. His first entrance, where he sort of just kind of arrives, steps out of the car, he's completely cranky, exhausted after the long journey, and he looks like a Greek god. I mean, there is no other way to describe Armie Hammer in this film. He is just simply divine. And what he does with his character is also excellent. He sort of moves from being this kind of chiseled, untouchable object of desire to being a full flesh and blood person who is extremely conflicted, seemingly very, very confident, but in fact actually quite frail, perhaps, in a kind of emotional way. And you sort of really chip into that external statue, you know, the Greek statue of his body, and you get into his mind and his heart.
Well, I think now would be an appropriate time to listen to the interview with Luca to learn a bit more about Elio and Oliver and Crema. So here is me talking to Luca Guadagnino. Right, so let's talk about the film Call Me By Your Name. Where I would like to start is actually the very, very beginning, before we met any of the characters. The opening titles, these archaeological artifacts, there's a lot of removed bodies and faces. They almost, these faces, to me anyway, they almost appeared like masks. As a kind of prelude or precursor for the rest of the film, how do you think those images relate to the story that you're about to tell?
Well, the way we decided to shape the title sequence, and something that I have a great enjoyment in doing usually, happened to be the way we thought of the narrative of the film. And basically what you see is the desk of Mr. Perlman. And because Mr. Perlman is an archaeologist, and one of the things that the archaeologist does is to file the images of the statues or whatever findings he has found. And so we thought of, like, how is the desk of a professor that is a bit eccentric and that has his own way of filing stuff. And so we put together all the little elements that that defines his world, his life, the times in which the movie is set, with these Xerox of pictures of the statues. So the assumption was that then what this leads to, what toward what, I don't know. It's up to an audience to understand.
Okay. And so where was your entry to the film? Did you find the novel? Were you given the script?
No, I've been approached to be part of this project as a consultant many years ago, almost 10, when these producers that are part of the producing team of this movie, Peter Spears and Howard Rosman, wanted to make this movie with a different script, a different director. And simply I grew into becoming more and more involved, and then before I was a consultant, then I became an executive producer, then I became a producer, and then eventually ended up being a director and producer of this film.
Okay, and for you, I mean, between I Am Love and A Bigger Splash, we had a relatively large gap, and now it feels like we're in the midst of a big creative flurry for you. What happened?
I never stopped being creative, no. To be honest, because between A Bigger Splash and I Am Love and A Bigger Splash, I had produced two feature films by two directors. I had directed one documentary that is called Italian Unconscious, feature documentary, and I co-directed another documentary called Bertolucci and Bertolucci. So I kept myself, and I directed an opera. So I kept myself quite busy, even in between. It's just that I didn't made many feature films, but I did a lot of other stuff. And so the kind of rhythm and the kind of pace of creativity, let's say, that I always had was the same. It's just that I did more in the last few years. I did more feature films.
Okay. So looking at Call Me By Your Name, before the cameras started rolling, you understand you spent a month with Timothy before filming, is that right?
Yeah, I think more than a month and a half.
So what was that? Was this where the film would be set, just building up character for him to relate to the landscape?
Well, we wanted him to be knowledgeable of a lot of stuff in the film. First of all, I think because he doesn't play a foreigner, he plays someone from that place. I wanted him to feel soaked into the place, not to find his measurements while shooting, but for him to have already understood what was in Crema. And then he went to understanding and learning more how to speak Italian. He went to understand and how to play better the piano, as he does fantastically in the film, the guitar. You know, like we soaked him into the atmosphere and the character.
Okay. And for you, was your familiarity with the location a way to help all the cast and the crew feel a bit more natural, do you think?
I don't know. That's something I try anyway.
Okay. Yeah. So you worked with Timothy for this month. With the chemistry between him and Army being so important for the film, did you ever worry about the moment that you would introduce them to each other?
No.
No?
No, because I was very confident about the fact that I was completely at ease with both personally. So I had no worry, no.
So something, I don't know whether how much... like this was part of your plan. Something I noticed about Armie Hammer's character, Oliver, is that the way that he arrives and leaves scenes is like he's quite quick in his movement. He's quite dramatic.
It's in the book.
Okay.
He's someone that goes away saying later. Mm. And that was a very nice kind of point from Asiman that it was important to keep.
Okay, and why do you think he does that? Was that a way that you could linger in the middle of the scene for longer, that you'd only have to keep the most important bit?
Why someone is uncommittal until it becomes very committal? It's something about that I think it's interesting to explore. I think someone can be showing uncommittal because cannot sustain the intensity of the commitment he is seeking or she is seeking. So in a way, it's a way of protecting yourself from the energy that comes off of the encounter with the other until you can't resist anymore. Mm. So it's a resistance.
And I think this does brush off on Elio as well.
Yeah, like he's sure. I agree completely.
Mm. So talking of the actors there, although what I wanted to ask is that you would not refer to them as actors, is that right? You would call these performers.
Yeah, I don't like the word actor.
Why is that?
There is something theatrical about actors. I'm not very much in love with the idea that actors are a species of people that seek the attention on them. I am not a great interest. I don't have a great interest in actors when they become some sort of egocentric machine. I like when people who perform are eager and able to show their absolute inner fragilities and being. And so I like basically people because they're strong, not because they're weak.
Okay. To me, it almost sounds in a way that actors makes me think of someone becoming someone else, whereas performing makes me feel like they are playing someone. So you've still got some essence of...
But to become someone else, it depends on how do you become someone else. And in general, it's important to think that whatever you become, whatever mask you put, the greatest aspect of the art of acting comes with the seemingly interaction between the portrait and the person who makes the portrait.
And so there are two moments that piqued my curiosity, and this is when the film reel becomes a bit visible and you get a sense of the film burn of the celluloid. I think it's a moment where Elio is reflecting and it becomes a bit faded. It's really beautiful to look at, but it's also a reminder that we are watching a film. Were these accidents in filming?
Were you pulled off of the movie in that moment?
No,
you were more soaked into the movie, correct? Yeah. It's you know, like, what's wrong about the cinematic experience?
No, well, I mean, that's like using this saying performers rather than actors, looking like seeing the film reel. I think there's a lot of awareness there that this is a film, but there's nothing wrong with that.
But for me, it's more about saying, look, how miraculous is the idea that you can capture on film the ephemeral emotion of this young boy. I think it's a reinforcement of the spell that cinema can make on you instead of taking you off and say, oh, look, it's just a movie. It's the opposite.
Okay. And with these planned moments?
No. They were just I'm being so prompt in defending the scene and saying, call it beautiful because it has not been planned, but it was a beautiful accident that happened that we kept in the film.
And other than that moment, how often was there a lot of moments in the film where you would just keep the camera rolling to capture?
No? I don't do that.
No?
I don't believe in that.
Okay. So was it quite a rigid set in terms of...
It's not rigid. It's something that has to do with me that I don't believe in. I don't believe in randomness. Do you know there is this thing that sometimes people say that in digital world you can shoot forever for an hour without never stopping the camera and whatever you capture then you use. I just don't buy this.
Okay. All right. So I want to ask about the romantically intimate scenes in the film. What I really loved about them is that they're not all completely silent and bottled up, that people are actually having fun and enjoying themselves and
laughing. The question
is,
how do you make love when you make love? Do you make love in a sort of hieratic and composed and self-contained way? Do you?
No, don't think I could be that.
I think you would
self-aware.
Be unsexy if you would do that, right?
Yeah.
I think you are a person and you live your moment with the person you have in front of you in a way that is committed to the way you are in that very moment.
And that's what
I don't like edited idea of an experience through the lens of the mise-en-scène. I think that's bullshit and it's something completely that turned me off. So sometimes you see these movies that are really like about the mise-en-scène of something. And they project an idea that has nothing to do with how things go in reality. There is a great moment in a movie by Martin Scorsese called The Cape Fear, the remake of J. Lee Thompson movie of the 60s. And in this moment, Nick Nolte and Jessica Lange, they've been wake up all night, terrified that the guy played by De Niro was going to trespass Travis Bickle. No, not Travis Bickle. Travis Bickle is the other character. Anyway, who was trespassing their house? And there is silence and they don't hear anything. They go into the kitchen and they see the maid on the floor. They don't realize that she's surrounded by a pond of blood, and they approach the corpse, and then they slip, and they start to slip on the floor, and they are ridiculous and goofy, and they start to be completely covered in blood, and it's goofy. It's fantastic. That is a moment in which I realized it. You, in front of death and in front of thriller, yet there is life that is more urgent. And it was a wonderful moment of Scorsese.
Well, that's what I love about these scenes in your film now, is just how much people actually seem to be enjoying themselves in each other's company in that physicality, rather than just staring at each other and heavy breathing all the time.
Awful. Would have been awful.
Right.
Yep. So we've mentioned Army and Timothy there. I just want to bring up Michael Stuhlbarg, who's excellent throughout the majority of the film as this very caring, intelligent, as you say, slightly eccentric father. Then there is this one scene on a sofa near the end of the film where he is completely remarkable, completely floored me. And when you were casting for the film, were you thinking with that scene in mind?
No. I think Mr. Perlman is in all things. As I told you, we start with Mr. Perlman's desk. So I don't know. It's not like going to the marketplace and say, give me a kilo of the best strawberries, or which would be the couch scene. You just think of the person who can be perfect for playing that role throughout the film. Of course, there is the important scene in the script, but that's part of the story. But it's not the aim for the character.
Mm. Okay. Luca Guadagnino, thank you so much for joining us. Guadagnino, sorry. Right, we are back and we can talk a bit more about Call Me By Your Name. And where I'd like to start is the opening titles. And if you've listened to the interview, that's where I also started there. Because I love these titles and these metal, sorry, well, they wouldn't be metal, these bronze figures, faces, masks. Well, they appeared like masks to me, and that played into a lot of the themes of the film about kind of detached bodies and identity. And there's this lovely kind of yellow brushstroke of titles for everyone's name, and this kind of really settled me into the mood of the film, because it's actually quite a really despite it's quite a choppy in the way that it moves around all these faces, it kind of really got you into the rhythm of the film. And the titles do come up in these quite swishy, quite long brush strokes.
It's also the images of the statues, and how you kind of go from certain details. I think it's a very good metaphor, and it's really lovely the way as a symbol it kind of crops up various ways through the film. So you see the pictures of the statues at the beginning, you start to combine these bodies, and it's very much the kind of way in which when you fall in love, particularly as a teenager, I think you kind of focus on certain details of the person that you like, and then you piece them all together, and then you go back to the details, and this sort of obsessive gaze continues to come up in the film. So that as Elio falls in love with Oliver and Oliver with Elio, really you have the same effect. You're kind of watching these bodies happen. And then we've talked about how the father is an archaeologist, and at some point in the middle of the film, they go on this trip where someone has discovered a statue that's been dug up, dredged up from Lake Sirmione. And there's this lovely scene where the father and Oliver are working on the images of his statue, and they do this kind of slideshow. And the father has this line where he says, look at these bodies, there's not a straight body among them. Look at these lines. Everything is impossibly twisted because of the shape.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
And the forms of these bodies, and he says this beautiful thing, they are impossibly twisted, they daring you to desire them, which is obviously exactly what he's watching his son and this young man do to each other, you know, kind of watch their bodies. And how this comes up at the end as well is sort of, it's a lovely really thread through the film. So it's lovely to see it introduced in the very, very beginning.
And in that moment, you kind of, you get a feeling that how much of a lovely lecturer he would be as
well. Oh, yeah. Definitely, yeah. Definitely. A very accepting and nurturing.
Yeah, and but he Stuhlbarg's delivery in that scene and a scene later on, he really thinks about everything that he's saying, and you can hear the pauses where he's just trying to pick exactly the right word. And in that moment, where that daring you to desire them, I can almost feel him kind of holding a pen and just kind of glancing away and just thinking, yeah, this is it, this is the right thing. And you would love to be his PhD student for a summer.
Absolutely, much as I would have loved to be Indiana Jones' PhD student. I would be the student with "I love you" written on my eyelids.
Michael Stuhlbarg is the new Indiana Jones.
As he goes X and never marks the spot.
Another thing to introduce me to completely fall for Oliver is when he takes over a conversation by saying, "I'm going to talk etymology for a second." And I thought you might like that line as well.
I love that line. I love the whole conversation. So the dad sets him up with this whole, this is the etymology of the word. What is the word? I can't remember what it is. And he goes, oh yeah, it comes from the Arabic, much like all of these other words that start with A-L. And then Oliver chips in with his great pickup line, I'm gonna talk etymology for a second, and kind of shows off, and you think, whoa, hang on a minute. And then the joke turns on him as well.
Yeah,
and they go, he does this every year.
Yeah, because that in that moment I wasn't sure if this is Oliver's character, that he is this overconfident guy. I wasn't sure if I'd be on his side. But then he just gets immediately taken down, and you think, okay, he's not as cool as we think he is.
He's completely set up.
But he does look very cool. I think everyone in this film looks very cool. And it's surprising, for me anyway, we get this oversaturated idea of a kind of bright, neon, garish 80s. Mm-hmm. And this is not that film. And for you personally, I believe this is a perfect 80s.
Absolutely. It's having grown up in 1980s Italy, which sort of dates me a bit, there was a lot in there. There was really recognizable, really relatable, and again, not that kind of revived picture of the 80s, but very much an authentic representation. There are certain details, particularly when they go into town on their bicycles and they walk into this little normal bar, you know, with elderly men playing cards and stuff, and every single prop and kind of set dressing that's in that scene, I believe you can probably still find in Crema these days. But, you know, everything from kind of from this big fridge where all the ice creams will be kept. And there's the kind of brand logo for the ice cream brand that every single child in the 80s wanted, you know, kind of El Dorado ice cream. I don't know if you noticed that, but that, to me, it was so recognizable. Elio wears a backpack that I used to have from this brand called Invicta, which every single Italian child had in the 80s. But also, it's just kind of the atmosphere as well is very much detached from the kind of 80s that you would normally see referenced in films, where they'd have like passing shots of televisions telling you what's happening in the world today. There's only a little bit of that when particularly the parents and the governess and the various kind of cleaning ladies and cooks in the house talk about contemporary politics. And they talk about Craxi, who was the new prime minister at the time in Italy. And that's sort of placing everything in a context that it's very, very specific to an Italian viewer, I guess, but it just felt incredibly realistic. I remember my parents having conversations about exactly the same kind of issues at the time. So it felt really fresh and very authentic.
There was something that really surprised me, was that they go into town and Oliver says that he needs to go to the bank. And he gets the reply of, oh no, the bank is closed for summer.
Yeah, of course. What was wrong with that? It's July. Everything's closed.
That just sounds like a dream. It sounds so lovely.
I am really amazed that he managed to open a bank account so quickly, to be honest.
Yeah, because it's kind of that kind of set up this idea of it almost kind of taking place outside of time in a way, that it is feeling like, I don't know, something like the Duke of Burgundy, where they're so swept up in their own romance that it doesn't almost in a way matter. Obviously here the setting is very important, but it's very much they are the key to it, and the idea that the town is almost closed and it's secluding them a bit more. Making this their own private place.
It's also a great testament to the really great way in which the film gives you the sense of summer. And there's a lot of silence in it. There's a lot of kind of contemplative times. And there is it reminded me of this poem, which I can only really quote in Italian because I don't know what the English translation is like. But it has this line, "Meriggiare pallido e assorto," meaning spending the afternoon in a pale, you know, sunlit but pale, quiet place. And it feels like this film absolutely captures that kind of that kind of feeling and the atmosphere, and the way summertime is a time out of time, out of place. You're completely free. You don't have to go to school. You don't have to study. You don't have to do anything. Even the things that Oliver is meant to be doing is his research. He's kind of, you know, lounging by the pool, reading. It's sort of all completely immersed in this luxurious time of the mind and time of the body and the heart. So it's it's really fantastic, I think, how that atmosphere is achieved.
And how long would that summer holiday be?
Oh, in Italy, it's kind of from mid-June to end of September, pretty much. You have to remember that it's about 40 degrees. Yeah, you can't really keep kids in a school room. You know, it's just kind of...
Because that is something that, the film kind of doesn't... It doesn't build like an ungodly temperature, but that feeling that you have... where it is just too hot to do anything else other than just listen to music or read. You've only kind of got it in you to do one thing at a time.
Absolutely. And in the way they spend their time is just perfect summer pastimes. You play volleyball with your friends, you go to the river, you go for a swim, you go for a bike ride. You sweat everywhere you are.
Yes. And so talking about the carrying on from the theme of the 80s, I think it would be a nice time to bring up the music in the film.
Yeah, there's a lot of 80s music, but the music that I really loved in the film is the classical music and the modern classical music as well. So a lot of it feels, so Elio spends a lot of his time transcribing music. He listens to music, classical music on his Walkman, and then he transcribes it, and then he really enjoys playing the piano and playing variations on the piano and kind of shows off a bit. And, you know, he's playing this theme by Bach, and Oliver says, "Oh, that's really cool, play it again." And so Elio plays it, but he plays it in a completely different way. It almost sounds like a different piece of music. And he says, "But you changed it. Why did you change it?" And he goes, "Well, I just changed it the way Liszt would have done it if he was playing Bach." And he's kind of, you know, he's playing around and fooling around, showing off how skilled he is. But at the same time, it's also a way for him to say, "Look at what I can do. Look at me.
That's a really nice moment in terms of Elio actually getting comfortable with the beginnings of their relationship. Because up until that point, he's really not sure of anything whatsoever. And that actually feels like, actually, no, I do want to impress him in a nice way. And he thinks, actually, I need to put a foot forward and I need to kind of present myself in a way. Yeah. And you can tell that Oliver's a bit taken aback by it.
Absolutely. And he's taken aback, but it's also the moment when he steps forward and says, "Please do this for me. Can you do it? Can you do it again? Why did you change it? Do it for me." And it's really, I think, at that point that the both of them recognize something in each other. Because before that, I think... as a sign of the vulnerability, they both put up quite a kind of front that says, "I'm too cool to talk to you. You're young. You're too old for me." And there's obviously this whole awkwardness about not really knowing what it is that's happening to you, which I think is very much what's happening to Elio. We should probably point out that of course, this is a beautiful love story between boys, but Ellie also has a girlfriend. Oliver, you know, probably has girlfriends, boyfriends, whatever is going on. And so there's a great, it's not a straightforward, oh, I'm gay kind of coming out story at all. It's really a story about learning to accept your desires for what they are and understanding yourself better in the process.
Yeah, and I think that's, we mentioned a moment later in the film with Michael Stuhlbarg kind of addressing those thoughts that I think Elio is still struggling with come the end of the film, that he's almost 95% there, but Stuhlbarg's character just kind of helps him not summarize but make sense of it.
That scene I think is extraordinary. I've always loved Michael Stuhlbarg. I think he's a great actor, and I would love to see him do more, but he is also absolutely extraordinary in these small roles where it looks like there isn't very much to do, but actually by the end of the film you almost have a sense that everything comes from his point of view, and he reveals something that is huge and that you would never have expected, and yet once you look back on the film from that moment makes complete sense. And to me, those are the best performances, when everything is so layered that you could take away the revelation and still have had something. And once you have the revelation, suddenly you have to change your point of view on that character. So I thought that scene at the end is absolutely fantastic. And I found it just really emotional. And somehow for me, this film has a really happy ending, even though it isn't, you know, in the long run, it's a summer romance. It's going to end. But there is something about that confrontation between father and son, and the father saying, you have to live it and don't allow yourself not to feel things, because he says to him, our bodies are given to us only once. And that's an incredibly philosophical thing, which, by the way, connects with Oliver's work. He works on Heraclitus, who is the philosopher. I think he's the one who says you can never step into the same river twice.
Okay.
Because everything would be different the second time around. So there's this really lovely kind of connection between all of the characters at this point.
And rivers. Actually, because there are two significant river moments.
Yes.
Because there is the first one where they kind of splash and play in, and it's quite innocent, and they jump in and say, oh, it's freezing, which I would not expect, because being stupid, I would think that obviously with the temperature, it's a nice warm.
They're near the Alps, so the river's coming down from probably a glacier.
And then later, so they and that's kind of at the early stage of their relationship. And later on, when they actually can go out by themselves, to me anyway, I'm assuming they kind of follow this river upstream and they track it to its source. Because earlier, when they talk about how cold it is, he says that this is coming right from the mountains. And so when they, what was the town that they go to again?
They go to Bergamo.
Okay. And they kind of climb. Yeah. And this, you've seen them in anoraks, and you spent the whole film seeing them just without their clothes on. And you think, oh God, this must be really wet and cold if they're putting anoraks on now. But I really like that idea of kind of them tracing this river to its source, after that's where they begin their physical relationship as well.
That's really lovely, and it's completely the invention of the film. It's there is kind of an equivalent moment in the novel, but it's very, very different. They go to a book launch and someone tells them a story about being in Thailand and encountering, kind of being attracted to this to this man and discovering it's a woman or something like that.
Right.
And it happens in Rome near this particular temple, where then something else happens. So that scene has been completely replaced in the film by this lovely kind of going to the source of the river, going up into the mountains, going somewhere where it's cold, and you can kind of, just placing these characters in a different context. But we haven't really talked much about the music, although we started
this came from,
I mean, it's a testament to this film that you can kind of pick any one topic and it will take you across the whole film. But there's also a few pop songs in the film which are used in a fairly brilliant and exciting way. So there's a lot of great awkward dancing.
Army dancing.
Yeah.
Have you seen the Twitter account?
Oh my God, yes. It's so full of joy. I mean, already Luca Guadagnino, I have to thank him for giving me my greatest dream, which was Ralph Fiennes dancing and lip syncing to the Rolling Stones. But army dancing is something else.
Yeah. He's got the moves. I'd be proud of those moves.
I'd be proud of those moves.
Yeah. It's really good dancing, really good music, and really good use of emojis on the Spotify playlist. It's just two men holding hands and then the peach emoji.
The peach.
It's lovely.
We're going to have to talk about this peach.
We'll address the peach in the room. But the other curious thing about the music is that there's original music by Sufjan Stevens. An artist who I really like, who I'm guessing you're a big fan of. And something that really struck me about the music was I'd seen the film already, went to watch something else, and the trailer played. And I was with my girlfriend, and she said, oh, she loved this song, which I thought was really interesting, because this song's original for the film. Uh-huh. And this is the first time you would have heard it. But I think that's actually a testament to the film for creating music that actually feels timeless instantly, and the fact that the modern classical music does not feel overtly modern. And this Sufjan Stevens music, there's three songs in the film, one used right at the end, which I know Timothy Chalamet had actually playing in his ear so that he would know exactly what the tone was, and it manages to bring this modern music and just make it feel completely at home.
Yeah, it's either that or every Sufjan Stevens song sounds the same.
Ah, no. No. Don't say that. No.
I say this as a fan, so just devil's advocate.
Yeah. But you said that about the war on drugs, and that's not true at all.
Well, that is a bit true.
Yeah, so that's music. And one thing that I'd like to ask you about, again, for this fantastic Italian insight, is the political subtext that's running through the film, which I really was not grappling with, that you could inform the listeners.
Yes, well, there's quite a bit. It's not obvious, and there's a lot of tiny little details from which you can kind of pick up on a political angle. I think Guadagnino is trying to place the romance and its location very much in the context of Italy, and trying to say something about Italy today, which is still, sadly, a fairly homophobic place. There's a couple of things that I want to say about the way the film treats politics, one of which I don't think particularly works, and it is sort of trying to phone in some kind of political subtext. So, for example, there's a scene where Elio and Oliver, who are both Jewish, we kind of, this is foregrounded at the beginning, and Oliver wears a Star of David, and later on, Elio also wears a Star of David once he notices that Oliver is wearing it, and they're cycling around, and they get hot, and they cycle up to this farmhouse, and they ask for a glass of water, and this lady goes to get them a glass of water, and just very, very subtly on the wall you see there's a picture of Mussolini, and Oliver kind of mentions it and says, oh, look, it's Il Duce, and nothing is really made of this. Likewise, later on, the sort of the cook and a couple of the maids in the house talk about contemporary politics, and they talk about, oh, you know, in the good old days, things were different. And this doesn't entirely work for me. I think there isn't, not enough is made of it. And there's a kind of just simple nod. I don't know. I don't think it's entirely successful.
If you're going to mention it, you need to mention it more properly.
What there is that's quite interesting is a scene with a couple of friends of the parents who come round for dinner. It's two elderly men, and they're a couple, and they are dressed in this kind of quite eccentric way. They're both wearing these bright color linen suits. In fact, one of them is Andrea Siman, who wrote the novel. The father, Elio's father, makes a comment to him saying, come on, you need to wear the shirt they gave you. You need to look, you know, and Elio is kind of making fun of them and saying, and the father says, is this because, you know, are you being like this because they are gay or because they're ridiculous? And obviously these two characters are a bit ridiculous. But at the same time, this is quite a clever way of bringing in some, sexual politics into the film, and really just, there's something very simple about it, and it's this, that it would be extremely brave of you to dress like that and to walk around with your partner in 1983 Italy, much as it still is today, I think. So that's somewhere where trying to bring in a political context really does work. Mm. It's done in a very subtle way, but it's smartly handled, and it's kind of in keeping with the themes of the film. So that to me was a really effective way of bringing in those two characters and making something out of them. Although the scene, I wish the scene could have been extended a little bit more, because that's kind of the only time when Elio meets people who are gay and who are explicitly gay and living happily, presumably. So it's sort of, I wanted that curiosity from him. I wanted him to want to investigate what that's like. But I think the film kind of steers away from it. And this actually made me think about the controversy about the film, which I think is a complete non-controversy. So the film has been criticized for not showing explicit sex, whereas the novel is very explicit and actually quite daring. And I think, I don't know, I think it would have been a completely different film if the level sexual kind of encounters were to be depicted in the same way as it is in the book. And I don't think that Call Me By Your Name does not show sex explicitly because of coyness. I think it decides not to do that out of probably a couple of things. One of them is respect for its very young protagonist, but also the respect for the very intimate experience that he's going through, which is not simple sex. It's the kind of loving sex that you discover, and that only, you know, the film makes a point of saying it happens to you once.
He'll be kind of inexperienced at this point and learning as well.
Oh yeah.
And that's maybe that, even if you're very, if you're uber confident, no one's going to want that documented anyway.
Yeah, exactly. So I think it's out of, you know, respect for privacy and the intimacy of this moment. In the book, incidentally, this is depicted very well. So there's a lot of kind of stopping and starting. And Oliver is very careful and constantly asks him, are you sure you want to do this? And this, after the first time they have sex in the book, Elio has this huge crisis. He says, nothing will ever be the same. Now I've done this. And what has happened to me? And what have I done? So that, I think this is depicted quite well in the film, but moving away from the detailed representation of sex. So to me, it's a non-controversy, much in the same way as I thought that the actual, you know, graphic nature of sex was completely inherent to God's Own Country and needed to be shown there. Here, I think we really needed not to see it.
Yeah. And my favorite bits of the intimacy that are shown on the film, which I bring up in the interview, is that people are actually having fun, that they're actually enjoying each other's bodies, and they're really friendly with each other, that they're not super intense all the time, that it's just play wrestling as well at points. And that's actually really nice to see, because it just shows how comfortable and how loving the relationship really is, that they can just kind of lose themselves to be silly.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's also the other element is the great curiosity about each other that they both have, about themselves and about each other, which might bring us to the peach.
Yes, we have not got much left, but we must talk about this peach and stone fruits in general. Because if there's a film that needs to do a promotional campaign with, I don't know, a stone fruit manufacturer, this is it. Stone fruits everywhere.
Italian peaches, Italian plums, Italian apricots.
Yeah, everything.
It's just occurred to me, that's the word, the etymology is the word apricot.
Even better. Oh god, yes. So yes, there is a scene which will stick in the mind with an invent where Elio has an inventive use for a peach.
Yes. Are we gonna go to there or not?
Maybe we shouldn't go fully there. Elio goes fully there, but maybe it's best left to the imagination. But I know there are some critics on Twitter saying, well, who amongst us isn't going to try it after this?
Oh, good grief, really? Poor peaches. This is cruelty against peaches. But jokes aside, I think, you know, it's again, in the book, this is described in quite some detail and stuff. And I think Timothy Chalamet does an incredible job in that scene, and how he goes from kind of being this lazed, bored teenager who's kind of, you know, waiting around between various episodes of sex, between various people as well, not just kind of, he's very sexual. He's kind of discovering his body and his own desires in various different ways. And his performance there is incredible. He goes from just kind of, you see him sort of entertain a thought Mm-hmm. You know, and for a moment, that's kind of just, oh, what am I thinking about? This is ridiculous. And then he just kind of becomes more and more curious. And it's a beautiful, wordless performance that's happening there. And somehow it feels completely natural to that character that he would just try anything. Mm. And what happens next as well, I just found, yeah, it's again part of this real playfulness and real curiosity between the two lovers. You know, sort of Oliver comes in and goes, what do you do?
Yeah.
But it's not like, oh my God, what did you do? It's disgusting. He goes, oh, okay, well, let me see.
Again, it's the celebration of bodies.
Celebration of bodies and everything that bodies do with each other and with themselves. And it really is one of the great onanistic scenes in film, I guess. Yeah. Not that I could catalogue many more of them. So let's leave this alone, I think.
We must wrap up there on that peach moment, or the peachy moment.
Peachy blinders.
Yeah. right, so do go and check out Call Me By Your Name. It's in cinemas now. Please watch it. It's one of the best films of the year. I'm sure you've read and heard so much about it already, and it does live up to every bit of hype. Also available for you to watch on Curzon Home Cinema, if you haven't had the chance, is I Am Not a Witch. And so that's in cinemas still, but if you can't make it to cinema, that is now on home cinema. It played at London Film Festival. We had the podcast on it last week with the Q&A as well, so make sure you check that out. And another thing I just want to do a quick shout out to is Boy, which is Taika Waititi's very underseen film. It was brought into the UK earlier in the year by Misc Films. It was shown a couple of times at the Prince Charles Cinema, and now it's going into cinemas. It's on Film 4, and it's going to be on Curzon Home Cinema as well. So that is Taika Waititi, the director of Thor Ragnarok, which is in cinemas now as well. But you can watch that, and do check out Boy and Hunt for the Wilder People as well, which I think is on Home Cinema too, if you want some Sam Neill, and who doesn't?
Both lovely films.
Yeah. So until next time, it is goodbye from Jake.
Goodbye.
And goodbye from Mia Renner. Goodbye.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.